It's time for Midweek Tech, episode 16 today, recorded on whatever day it is today.
It is Wednesday, believe it or not, the day we always do Midweek Tech.
Yeah. I'm your host, Michael McAndrew, and as always, I am joined by Tig Wagstaff. How are you today, Tig?
I'm all right. My hair isn't doing what it's supposed to. I got a very fancy new watch. It was on a huge sale, so yeah, cool. Good, lucky me. And I'm grooving out to our new theme tune music, which is just unbelievable.
Yes.
Yeah. Like it, how are you today?
I'm good. That intro was a bit messed up, but we better keep it going.
Keep it going. Fair enough. Today we're going to be talking about a few things. Today it was actually my turn, for once, to pick what we're doing, which is the scary prospect, because I'm not very good at lining things up. I'm not a logistics person. And so I chose a few different but very interesting things.
Yeah, definitely.
I actually have something I'd just like to say at the moment we didn't do in the pre-warm-up. I have another thing I think we should talk about, and maybe we could start off with this now. The dispute between Samsung and Apple has ended in blood. Have you heard about it yet? It's still in the court at the moment.
Yeah.
And it's a dispute that Samsung have been entirely copying Apple with the Samsung Galaxy S, which I think is a bit of I honestly think that's rubbish. I'm trying to find airable words, kind of words I'm allowed to use on air to describe how I feel about this. I feel like Apple are being inconsiderate. I'm sorry, this is struggling. I'm struggling somewhat. You know what I mean. I think Apple are being absolutely ridiculous.
Okay.
I think it's a ridiculous claim. They have absolutely no clause to say as such, and even mentioning such a thing is just... Well, for a start, it's stunting all their competition, which is what they want. They want a monopoly, and you can't blame them. Everyone wants a monopoly. It's good business. But I think it's taking things just one step too far, and I think you can't honestly say that Samsung copied them that much.
Well, okay. First of all, I don't really like talking about legal things, because it doesn't really have much to do with technology, but this is kind of the biggest court case of the century, is what they're saying so far. And yeah, my opinion on it is Apple are trying, I mean, when you hear Apple's side of it, it's like, oh, well, Samsung does all this stuff like gestures. So, and then the judge says, okay, so now you own this gesture? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So there are, yeah, I think that Samsung... They're not copying Apple. They're not copying Apple.
I know what you mean. I found the words for it. I think Apple think that by making the iPhone, they have patented various things that they have not patented at all. But I think that they're under the illusion that they have somehow patented, you know, things like a touchscreen phone.
Exactly.
I think that copying the shape of their phone is patented. It's not.
Yeah.
Copying their logo would be patented.
Yeah.
Copying their operating system to any various or too, you know, too straightly would be patented. But they're thinking that because they've used all these colored icons and the same slidey motion that you can do with your fingers and effectively recreated the iPhone in that way, they think that it's illegal, but they've actually done nothing illegal or wrong, because none of this has been patented. Anybody can do it.
And yeah, I you're think exactly
that
right.
Under that reason, it's an invalid court case to bring up, and I don't believe they should be doing it. Even if they did have the intention of copying Apple, there's nothing in the law that says you can't do that.
Right, so you know, maybe they might have copied some things, but everyone copies from each other. A good example is if you have an Android phone, you know, there's a notification bar that you can bring down. Apple took that straight out of Android with into iOS 5, where they brought in Notification Center. You know, that's basically a direct copy of that. So everybody copies from everybody else, and if nobody copied from anybody, it wouldn't be... I mean... So Apple brought out a touchscreen phone with... They were pretty much the first company to bring out a capacitive touchscreen phone that you didn't have to press down very, very hard on the screen. And then other companies started to use the capacitive screens. And, you know, if Apple had patented that and no other company were allowed to use the capacitive touchscreen, that wouldn't be very good, would it?
Well, yeah. No. I mean, that would stunt... That would stunt innovation.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's one of the main arguments coming up, the whole SOPA internet debates. And it's the same, I feel, hardware, software, non-digital media. It's the same everywhere. It's the same with every type of invention you could possibly conceive, be it medical, be it technological, and so forth. If you patent everything, that A, creates a monopoly, and balloons out inflation because you have to pay so much for these devices. B, it stunts innovation. Nobody can make something better of what you have than you have. It means that the quality of products and what's being released into the market is shortened and stunted because you're not letting anybody use this and improve upon what you already have. And really, from a very human perspective, it's a bad thing to do. It ruins society when people stunt innovation like that.
Yeah, well, what I'm really interested in is the technology behind this. So, Apple, basically, the first day of this, they said, okay, Apple and Samsung, if you want to truly commit to this, you're going to have to completely just show any evidence, right? So, anything that can be used as evidence. And that included iPhone prototypes, which was very interesting to see. There was some very interesting images of early iPhone prototypes, and, you know, we saw some very interesting things that we would have never seen because Apple is so secretive about their stuff. We would have never seen if this court case had never happened. So that's what I'm very interested in, is just seeing the early Apple prototypes of the different things, and of course the Samsung prototypes of their devices as well, to see the similarities.
Well, as well as that, as I was reading through what actually happened in the court case and the main points that each other had brought to the table, and one of the main things that they had brought up was that you had to take everything from the point of view, and this is, I think, Apple are bringing in heavily on the legal you're copying us side, which even though they know they can't do because they have patents, they do have very good legal lawyers and such. And basically what they said is what all good lawyers and etc. do is you make a timeline of what happened. For instance, you don't have to patent something if you can prove that you gave the copy to your lawyer 3 days before they did. That means that it's still your invention because you got it, and you got it safely. You got a copy of it safely to your lawyer before they did. So they definitely can tell that you had a working copy before the other person did. This is a very important concept in law, and that's what Apple based on. And they said, right, what you first have to do is make a timeline. And they brought that to the table saying, it took us 5 years to do this, we started 5 years beforehand, and in 6 months Samsung copied us. And in my opinion, that's a bit like saying, I painted a painting, and it was generally renowned as a work of art, and the person who sat beside me 2 weeks later painted something similar under similar kind of tags with a similar expectation of what would happen, and then that became a masterpiece as well. And even though mine was appreciated more, I should go after him because he copied me. I think that's being spoiled more than anything. I know it is, in business sense, is sensible to try and keep your monopoly, but I think it's being spoiled, and I think it's, as I've said before, stunting innovation.
Right, well, we have something that we're going to move on to now, which is very, very interesting, that I was looking at during the week. There was a TED Talk about it from a guy from MIT talking a bit about femtophotography.
Yeah.
Which is just something that I'm kind of struggling on to understand how they can actually do this. So, Thai, you might just give us a bit of an overview of what femtophotography actually is.
Femtophotography, and don't quote me on any of this because I'm new to it as well, but I was blown away. We just had to talk about it. Is recording in billionths of a second. Mm. And I mean, like, this is the point where you could see light moving, and you know that light is the fastest thing ever. I'm talking about, like, watching light moving. And that's not, you know, that's not easy. Light is the fastest thing ever. You need light to watch it. And it's just mind-boggling. I mean, the only other thing that really moves at the speed of light is electricity, which I suppose what enables us to do this. But there was a clip. You could see a bullet, a photon of light being shot through a bottle of Coke with clear water in it. Now, to see light moving is one of the most immensely difficult things ever. If you turn on a light bulb, right, the light will take a minute to warm up because of what the light bulb's actually made of, but the light that comes from as soon as it comes into range where it can spread, I mean, it's so quick, it's instant. It's as instant as anything will ever be. It is instant. It is the concept of instant. The concept of instant is not possible because things can only move as fast as the speed of light. And this is in relativity. We're not going to go any further into that because, you know, there's quantum physics and blah, blah. It can be debated, but for what we're talking about, we're going to say that light is the fastest thing ever. For something to move
well,
in an instant,
you do have the, I don't know how you, there's multiple pronunciations of the
Higgs boson is the
boson,
godlight.
Boson, boson.
It's the Higgs boson or Higgs boson is all I've ever heard.
Okay. But that has that been actually scientifically proven? That it is faster than the speed of light? That it is?
Well, no, I think you're being confused. CERN came out and said that there was a subparticle that moves faster than the speed of light.
Okay.
And it was neutrino. The Higgs boson, now that's been disproven.
Okay.
And the Higgs boson has been found, and that's an even bigger ruckus because it completes our current model of physics. It's what gives all of everything ever mass. It what makes stuff stuff.
Yes.
It's what makes stuff not just floating around. Uh-huh. It's what makes my hand. It's very difficult to describe. It's what makes stuff stuff. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's what grants the universe solids and liquids and gases. It's called the God particle for a reason. People think God made all of this and that's why there is anything ever. I'm not going to get into the theology of why that is difficult to explain, because at the end of the day, if God made that, God has to be something and there couldn't be nothing and then something because there's God, but I'm not going to get into that. This Higgs boson is supposed to be the answer to it, and it's a bit ignorant if you ask me. It's not a be-all and end-all because, well, frankly, we don't know how it works yet, either. But it has been found, and the Higgs boson is what's supposed to give everything mass. And now mm-hmm. they found it, they're like, oh my god, because they've been searching for it for, like, ever. It's from the beginning of time. It's what people have been thinking about. What gives stuff stuff? What makes things things? And the Higgs boson is what does that. And I'm not going to try and explain it, because I have a very vague understanding of it. But it's probably wrong, and even that would take, you know, who knows how long to explain, and I'd probably be misleading you all because I don't understand it because it's really bloody complicated. And I'm just saying you're being misled there. The Higgs boson is just like any other particle. It has form, except it's a lot more extraordinary, I think. But it does not move faster than the speed of light, no. But people did think that neutrino moved faster than the speed of light, which was discovered about 2 months, maybe, before the Higgs boson. And they thought that that would mean the Higgs boson or any of the other particles made no sense at all, because if something moved faster than the speed of light, everything we know about particle physics at the moment would be wrong. That's why it was so groundbreaking. No, it turned out just to be an error in testing.
Okay.
But, yeah, okay. What were you talking about originally?
We were talking about femtophotography. Yes, that's what we were talking about. So what they do, if I'm correct in this, now, correct me at any time if I'm getting this wrong. they have a camera that can record at 1 trillion frames per second. How is that possible, first of all? I actually absolutely haven't got a clue how they can, how they have a camera that can record at 1 trillion frames per second. Do you know how
they can do it? I mean, I was about to say electromagnets. Now that is a very typical answer of things, but electromagnets are how the LHC works. So how they get particles fast enough to collide and explode is they have femtophotography. I'm not going to ask who's that in the chat room. Femtophotography is spelt with an F, by the way. What was that? Oh, yeah. So how the LHC works, really, essentially, is by taking away an electron from an atom, and that makes it positive, and it makes it attracted to negative electromagnets. Once you pump electricity through something, it becomes negatively charged, I think. And then they pump lots of electricity through hundreds of electromagnets, and that speeds it up, but it's in a loop. And they're turning on and off and on and off and on and off, so it's accelerating. And then when it gets to here, say this is the ring, it's accelerating. When it gets to here, this one turns off, this one turns on, so it goes faster. And it's rimming on the edge as fast as it can until it's like something like a third of the speed of light, which is ridiculously difficult because once something gets, the faster something gets, the more mass it has. Sorry, I'm doing these strange hand movements. I think it's because I'm struggling to explain.
So,
but basically that's how it gets to a third of the speed of light. I was thinking it might be something to do with electromagnets in a similar fashion. I don't know.
Okay, so it records at a trillion frames per second, and then they slow it down by 10 billion times. So they record sending a beam of light through this Coke bottle of Coke, and full of water, and then they slow it down by 10 billion times, and they can see the light
they can
making
see
what, its way what they, through the bottle.
Right, so, you know the way I said that light is an instant, right?
Yeah.
To show you how mind-bogglingly, stupidly complex it is, imagine slowing down an instant, right? An instant being the smallest amount of time imaginable, an instant just being snap, and it's there. And you can't see right there. They're basically recording the fastest thing ever. They're basically recording something that's so fast that there is no measurement of time for it. They're basically recording something so fast that it doesn't take time. It's so fast that it doesn't take measurable time. But they're slowing it down so much they can actually see it moving. They turned it on and off in an instant, and there was this bullet of light, and you can see it, bam, hitting the Coke bottle, and dispersing into the bottle and the water. That's like impossible. I don't know how more to explain it. Can you grasp this?
It is quite. So this is actually it right now. I'm showing this on the video. So this is the beam of light going through this bottle. And so, okay, so
yeah,
it's cool. so this beam of light is just a single proton of light.
Well, it's as close as they can get to a single proton of light. Bear in mind how quickly light disperses, so they have to open and shut the shutter. So it's probably many protons of light going through.
Yes, that's what I
thought.
Because
they can't do it, because that would require having a shutter that is the
yes,
speed of light.
Yes, exactly.
Just
no.
Like one proton too.
Well, they would have to have, yes, that's what I thought. So I thought it was like probably about hundreds of protons of light going through here, because there's no way you'd be able to capture it at the speed of light. Okay. So I don't want to get into the crazy detail about this, because I don't even understand that. But all I know is it's cool. And that it is something that is just really, really groundbreaking.
They've just figured out how to do. It's just the reason why we're telling you about this mind-boggling thing is because, you know, people are managing to cut the boundaries of reality as we know it. And, you know, we should all know about this. And it's shocking the amount of people that don't know a thing about all these things that people are discovering about our reality. We're discovering, like, we're discovering what makes up our world. We've recently discovered what makes stuff, as in from nothing to something, no dimensions ever, not air, not open space, just nothing ever, into something, sometime, space, dimensions, time. And people, the amount of people who just don't know this and don't know what it means, and it's an awful shame because it's very interesting. And then now there are people who are being able to record at watch light move. People are breaking time, figuring out what makes time, figuring out what makes stuff and the physical dimensions. It's just interesting, and everyone needs to know about it. And that's why it's on Talks About Tech, because we're nice people, and we want you all to have a happy and interesting life. But, yeah, okay, so that's that. Are we, anything else to
say? I just want to put into perspective what 1 trillion frames per second is. Okay? So, at the moment, what I'm recording in right now is 25 frames per second. So, as you see my hand moving, it's capturing my hand at 25 frames per second. That's what you're seeing. On the recording or on the live stream, you're seeing my hand moving in 25 frames per second. So, 1 trillion frames per second. I mean, even 25 frames per second, that's 25 frames. That's 25... 25 in 1 second.
That's 20. That's, by the way, guys, just to put that into perspective, yeah. That's what video is. Video isn't video. It's lots of pictures put together.
And exactly, yeah.
Played one after the other.
Yep.
So it sees me moving, and it takes many pictures at once and puts them one after another. And because the human eye can only differentiate between so much, that's why we get motion blur. Put your hand in front of your face, move it. You can see motion blur because your eye can't process all that so quickly. So when we play one picture after another, it looks like real life video instead of looking like one picture after another. Now 25 frames a second is 25 pictures in a second.
So could you imagine 1 trillion pictures taken in 1 second? Crazy. Yeah,
first of all, let's put into perspective what a trillion is.
Yes.
Right. So we have a decimal. 1, 10, 100, 1,000. 1,000 thousands is 1,000,000. 1,000 millions is 1,000,000,000. 1,000 billions is 1,000,000,000,000. So hold on. Let me just get notepad up. Let me tell you how many zeros that is. 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000. 1,000,000, 10,000,000, 100,000,000, 1,000,000,000, 10,000,000,000, 100,000,000,000, and 1 trillion. That's so, 1 and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. That's 1, 12 zeros.
Oh my god. Okay. That is a big number. That is a very, very big number.
Yeah.
Wow. That is pretty good. So, yeah, that's what it's recording at, which is absolutely crazy. Anyway, so what can you do with this anyway? That's the thing.
Well, you can record things at the speed of light, and what they really use it for is watching nukes blow up. Because the only way you can really test a nuke and see that it's exploding, right? You can't have some guy and say, hey, stand here and we're going to see how many bits your body gets blown into when we put you a mile off a nuke. Because nukes are big enough, you know. If you put a guy a mile away from the nuke, he'll still die. These are nuclear bombs we're talking about, you know. If he doesn't die from the fireball or the air blast, he'll die from the radiation or the thermal radiation. I'm not going to go into that until our next bit, which is actually about that. But anyway, you have to watch it. You have to put it in a very remote location and watch it through at a trillion frames a second to see exactly what's happening. And a guy who obviously doesn't understand what we're doing, and I don't know who he is, but he's called himself Perma Potato Photography. They test it in Siberia and other remote locations where nobody actually goes. They say nobody goes. They pay no attention to the fact that people do sometimes live there, and all the environment there is destroyed for however long.
So
they do test these things because they're militant nut jobs.
So the guys in MIT who kind of, they're doing a lot of testing of femtophotography. What they did was they tried to use light reflection to find out, to see invisible things, right? So what they did was they hid a mannequin, right, behind a wall, and then they reflected light, they reflected protons of light onto another wall, then it reflected off that wall, hit off the mannequin, reflected off the mannequin, back onto the wall again, and then reflected off the wall back to the camera. And they got a result. So they actually saw, I mean, it was an outline of the mannequin. It wasn't exactly a very detailed image of the mannequin, but it was pretty close. Because, so you're sending out a group of protons, it gets split, and a few of those, or maybe 50 of those protons will hit the mannequin, split again, maybe 20 of the protons will hit back against the wall again, and then maybe only a few little protons will hit the camera again and capture that. So it's very, very complex stuff, but that's what they can do, which is very, very cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Being able to see the
essentially
invisible.
I mean, it's mind-blowing, the kind of stuff that happens and is done and stuff. Anyway, now that we've explained that, do you want to move on? Because I'm getting more and more mind-boggled, and I have less and less to talk about because I don't understand the subject.
Sure. Yeah, so I think we should move on to talk about how to store stuff. Because you can imagine, if you're recording at a trillion frames per second, how can you record? That must be absolute massive amount of data.
I mean, put it this way. If one picture, one high-quality picture takes up, let's say, 2 megabytes, we're going to talk now about how they can record 30 frames a second movies. 30 frames a second movies, right? So that's 30 pictures a second, so that's 30 times 2 megabytes, so that's 60 megabytes. And then they have an hour of it, which is 60 multiplied by 60. I mean, in theory, that would actually take up a lot more than it does. It would take up about 100 gig for a large film. But,
yep.
Like, this is in theory. Sorry, my head can't be seen on this. That's irritating.
It's actually, you might turn on the light, because...
Oh, it's getting dark, isn't it?
Very
dark.
Hold
on. I'm going to shut my windows because the Mozzies come in and ceiling, and I have to kill them all, and that's awfully unfortunate. So I'm going to shut my windows before I turn the light on. Anyway, just to finish my little... Oh, wait, what was I saying?
You were saying about a 30 frame per second video.
Oh, yeah. It would actually be a couple of hundred gigabytes. And can you imagine trying to store, like, two films... 200 gigabytes. You take up an entire laptop to store two films. Now, the way people do it is actually a lot more complicated and clever.
Yeah.
And that is what we will be explaining. We will also be explaining generally what storage is, how you store things, and so forth, and so forth.
So, I'm going to talk a bit about, for a little while, the different types of storage. The different types, you know, your average... type of storing something, how you would normally store something. So the normal way, if you have a computer, let's say you had photos or something and you wanted to store them, you'd probably store them on the hard drive of the computer. So that's one way of storing your stuff. Now we'll be getting into more detail about how a hard drive works, how flash memory works and things like that later on. And then the next thing, I mean, something that's new that's coming out is flash memory. So you might get an SSD for your computers. So that's it's a hard drive, but it's got flash memory on it. And we'll be explaining the difference between a standard hard drive, spinning hard drive, and a flash hard drive in just a minute. And, you know, you might also store it on a memory stick, which also uses flash memory, that plugs into your USB port. Now, Permapotatography is saying that how an SSD costs a lot of money. And we'll be explaining a bit why it costs so much money in just a little while. So, they're the main kind of types of storage. Flash storage is mainly used in mobile phones, iPods and things like that, because it takes up such little space. So, Thang, you're back.
Yeah, I am.
So the first storage I talked about was your average spinning hard drive that pretty much everyone has in their computers. How does that work? How does it store stuff, Thang?
Dry throat, but best reading voice. Nearly every desktop computer and server in use today contains one or more hard disks. Every mainframe and supercomputer is normally connected to hundreds of them. You can even find VCR-type disks and camcorders that use hard disks instead of tape. These billions even of hard disks do one thing well. They store changing digital information in a relatively permanent form. They give computers the ability to remember things when the power goes out. Here, I'm going to share my screen with you on Skype instead of having my face. See how that works. This is probably not going to work, guys. Sorry for any formatting errors. Yeah, this is the article we're on. Yeah, so this will show you images and things. Now, hard disk basics. Hard disks were invented in the 1950s. They started as large disks up to 20 inches in diameter, holding just a few megabytes. That's right, people. Back in the olden days, a megabyte used to be a lot. Better get your head around it, because we are accelerating pretty fast in tech, and soon a gigabyte is going to be a small amount of data. Soon a terabyte is going to be a small amount of data. Hard disks were invented... They're originally called fixed disks, or Winchesters, a code name for the popular IBM product. Later, they became known as hard disks. We distinguish them from floppy disks, as hard disks have a hard platter that holds the magnetic medium, as opposed to the flexible plastic film found in tapes or floppies. At the simplest level, a hard disk is not that different from a cassette tape. Both hard disks and cassette tapes use the same magnetic recording techniques. As discs and cassette tapes also share a number of major benefits of magnetic storage. The magnetic medium can easily be erased and rewritten. It will magnetic flux patterns stored in the medium for many years. In the next section, we'll talk about the main differences between cassette tapes and hard disks. Anyway, that basically tells you how you do it. Magnetic.
Right.
Magnetic writing.
Okay, so now what I'm interested in is permapotatography. Was asking in the... He was saying that... how expensive SSDs are, which is basically a form of flash storage. Right, so I want to know what the difference is between flash storage and your normal spinning hard drive, if you'd be able to answer that. Pike.
Sorry, yeah. I will look it up now, because I also don't know anything about flash storage. Are we talking about the practical differences?
We're talking about how it actually works.
How
the difference in how it actually works. Flash storage does not spin around, and that's why it makes less noise, less sound. Right?
How flash memory works. Flash memory is a type of EEPROM chip, which stands for Electronically Erasable Programmable Read-Only Memory. It has grids of columns and rows with a cell that has two transsections at each intersection. Can you see that diagram I'm showing now?
Yes, I can.
I don't understand. If you can, go ahead. So this is the way the current goes. The blue bit is the current. Negatively charged electrons, as I said before, negatively charged electrons attract the positive.
It doesn't have any moving parts, essentially.
Yeah, essentially it doesn't have any moving parts. It's just a big circuit.
A regular hard drive will fail on you because it moves. It moves around. It's got physical parts and it will fail on you. Whereas an SSD, which is flash memory, will not. Now, it does have a limited number of read and write times. So there's a limited amount of times that you can read and write to an SSD.
But having said that, these limited write times, it's up in the millions.
Yes. Or the billions. Yes. So it'll last you a very, very long time. And that's why SSDs...
Rechargeable batteries do not last forever. They only last for about a billion recharges. But you're probably not going to last that long before you lose it.
Yeah, and that's why SSDs are so... they're so expensive, is because they last so long. Right? And your average hard drive will fail on you eventually. It definitely will fail on you. So, right. That is the difference between flash storage and your standard hard drive. Okay.
It's complex.
Yes. So, now we're going to talk a bit about a new type of storing data that is not flash or a hard drive or a cassette or a tape or a CD or DVD or anything like that. It's how to store data in DNA.
Dot, dot, dot. Now, okay, can I explain the concept behind this?
Yeah.
So, we all know how we are made here, right? I presume we've all done some form of biology. I don't know how extreme that knowledge is and all, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When we are being built, when we are being made, when we are growing, our cells split. And then split, 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 and so forth to make more cells. They effectively clone themselves. In each of those cells, there's a nucleus, which acts as the brain, and on those nucleus, there are chromosomes. Now, on those chromosomes, there are caps to protect it from damage, and written on the chromosomes are DNA. DNA is like a biological code. In fact, it is biological code. We represent it with letters, although it's nothing like that at all. We can't really explain it because we don't know much about it. It tells us that when our cells reach there, they're going to stop forming in the finger and go and do something more useful and grow my shoulder out some more. And it's how we're not just big blobs of just flesh. We are the complicated beings we are, with bones, flesh, muscles, respiratory systems, so forth and so forth. So DNA is our code. Now, so a cell is extremely small. You know, you have to zoom in 200 times or so to begin to start to see cells, right?
Yeah.
Now, when you've done that, zoom in another 1,000 times and you might be able to see DNA, right?
Right.
Okay, right. And on this DNA, there are, say, 1 million bits of information. So that's another million smaller. We're getting into now, like...
So,
I'm not sure if these measurements are exact. We're getting into, like, billions of magnifications inwards.
So DNA, it stores data in, it's like a sequence of code or numbers or...
Yeah, we all know binary, and that's, most people don't actually understand binary in the smallest sense, but because a lot of people just think it's a bunch of one and o's, and effectively it is.
It's just the sequence in which they're in.
Yeah.
Is what makes sense.
One and o stands for on and off. Now, on DNA... we have a relative thing, except we have them in different values. T, G, and A, I think, what we use to represent them, and etc. But what we have to assume here is if, and this is totally, I'm making this figure up, If, say, a billion watt... Okay, so a byte of data. Let's say a byte of data, 10 ones rows. And then once you have that byte of data, you go up and up and up. And then say that enough ones and O's to make a text document that says, Tig is cool, be able to save it and reopen it. Say that takes up a megabyte of space, right? Mm-hmm. Say the program of the notepad, so the notepad that says, right, you can write on this, and says what you can write, and says you can save and edit. Say that is as complicated as some of the DNA on our nucleus, right?
Yeah.
Except the data on the DNA is 100 times more dense and can be fitted in such a smaller place. So, like, for instance, let's say I could store 1 million films on all the DNA in 1/100th of the nail on my pinky finger. So what they're trying to do is they already know that DNAs work, so they want to recreate it. Recreate it for more recreational use, like technology. So what Harvard and all the other big universities have done is they're just trying to recreate DNA and be able to use it.
So, okay. So here's what they're doing. I have a diagram here. What they're doing is they're taking data from what I understand is, and then they're encoding that into what DNA records data in. Right?
Yeah.
And then they're storing it on the DNA. That's how they're storing it on the DNA. And then if they want to get access to that, they have to decode it back from that DNA language, we'll call it, back into ones and zeros so that they can understand what it is.
Yeah, but then you have to imagine that on one cell they can store 1 million films, as opposed to you could store 1 million films on, say, 1 million films. That'd be like, I don't even want to guess. 1 million films would be like, let's call it 1,000 terabytes. And if a 1 terabyte hard drive is generally what we use at the moment and it's that big, it's another, 1,000 of these. Or you could store it on something that's like that small. Basically what they're trying to do is they're making a more perfect way of data storing, a practically perfect way of storing data. It's biological, so it's not really harmful for the environment, like mercury used in some devices,
and so forth.
Basically, it's an almost perfect way of storing data.
But how do they read that? So how do they, first of all, how do they put the data on the DNA? And then second of all, how do they take the DNA off? How do they read, or not the DNA, how do they read the data and get the data off the DNA afterwards?
I'm pretty sure it's just a simple coding of, it's a simple, oh my god, it's a simple process of encoding and unencoding. They don't have a more efficient way yet. They don't have any recompilers or anything. But I'm fairly sure it's just a... it encodes it into DNA, and then when it comes back, it has to unencode it. They basically just use codecs. They basically just use codecs for DNA.
Okay.
Film codecs. For those of you who don't understand film codecs are... All film is written in its own little languages, and all ways of viewing film is written in its own little languages. And your PC has to have codecs to read them. It has to be able to understand the language that it's written in. And for that, you need a codec, which is like a translator. So basically, they're using a digital translator.
Yeah. Okay, so you wanted to go on to something a bit different now? Am I right,
Yes.
Thig? Yes, a game?
Which one?
I believe you wanted to talk about Slender.
Now, a few people in here... Oh, great, everyone's leaving. So, that bored guy, who's some random guy... Slender, new horror game. Absolutely brilliant. It's an immersion game. So what immersion is it kind of immerses you into the atmosphere and the general whole shebang. It tries to immerse you into the scene you're in. Now normally these games they're not that scary. They make good attempts and they're good games, but at the end of the day I just don't find horror scary. I don't find horror films, I don't find horror games, I don't find any of that actually menacing, because it's just I think it's a bit silly, some of the culture, because everybody gets so pent up and so scared over these things that I just don't understand. And, yeah, I just don't get scared by these things is the basic story of it. But now there is Slender, which is the new immersion game. And even for me, I find it pretty creepy. I find it pretty creepy in a very kind of a base sense, because, well, it's based on urban mythology. I can't really explain it all because it's complicated. The urban mythology doesn't really matter. But the point is that it's a scary thing to look at. It's not gruesome, it's not gory. It's just, it's kind of the thing where you look at it and from a very human perspective you're like, that's not right. That shouldn't look like that. And it's not in a, that's not right, that shouldn't look like that. It's the wrong way around sense. It's like, that's not right, that shouldn't look like that. I don't want to be near that. And it's not gory, it's not bloody, it doesn't involve killing anything. But basically, what the game is you're trying to find 8 pages, basically, in this little woody environment they've built. Now, the first page, there's almost no chance he'll run into the Slenderman, and I'll explain how this is coded now. It's coded so each time you get a new page, the Slenderman acts differently. Mm-hmm. And so at first, the Slenderman is just at one end of the map. You're very unlikely to run into him. He's only at one place. By the time you get the second page, it's something like, if you go deep into the woods, he's always at your back right if you turn fast enough. So if you turn straight around, look at the back right of you, he's there. And the scary bit of the game is seeing him. Because seeing him gives you all this static on your screen, and it starts with the scary noises, and this scary thing you just don't want to be near. You're just like, get away from me, all right?
Okay, this is definitely not my type of game,
scary,
then.
But it's like, I don't want to be near this object. And the point is, the object comes to you, and you can't outrun it. There are no guns. It's not a gunning game. You can't shoot it. You just have to stay away from it. And the coding gradually gets worse and worse and worse. So once you're at the fifth object, he's always, exactly on your left and right, so you can't turn very quickly at all, or you'll see him. And I think it's by the seventh object, by the time you have to find the eighth page, he will find you in 10 seconds, no matter where you look. So the Slenderman is everywhere in 10 seconds. So you have to find the 8th page by 10 seconds. So it gets, gradually and gradually worse. And it's this really eerie setting with lots of different places. So you're in a forest, it's at night, it's got the creepy music playing, and you're like, this game isn't going to be scary at all. And then when you see the Slenderman and he comes up to you and he grabs you and the static's everywhere and you can hear the screaming and it's this thing, and you're just like, I don't want to be near this, get it away from me. It's just like, it's not like, oh my god, that's really scary, that's gruesome. It's just like, it's startling. It's a startling game. It's a startling game where you look at something startling that comes and chases you. And it's not gory, but it's just brilliant. I mean, it's the only horror that's ever actually scared or, that's ever disrupted me. And it's very good. And one of the reasons, first of all, everyone should play it. Because, it's not scary like I'm not going to sleep at night scary. It's scary like, Jesus, that's actually quite menacing. And then it's like the shock's over. So it's fun in that sense. Secondly, it's made by an indie developer. It was made with almost no support at all. And it was made, you know. You know, it's like Minecraft. It was just made as a bit of an experiment by some people called Parsec Productions. I don't know if they've actually done anything else. I'm not very big. They could be quite big, but it is indie. And it's just exploded because of all the reaction videos. Watching people play it is just the funniest thing. And I'll link you to a video after this, or I'll make sure the video link gets put in. And it's a video of this man playing Slender. And he just does it with all the lights off and headphones and his laptop, and he's just there. This isn't going to be scary at all. And by the end of the game, he's just panting. He's just like, I hate this game. I just hate this game. And I don't really know how to describe it. It's just a really good horror. It's the best horror I've ever played. Ever. Ever.
Well.
And I think everybody should play it. And it's called Slender. Download it. It's free. And just play it a couple of rounds. If you don't like it, you don't have to. But it's just good. It's good. It's just an awesome game. Just play it. Play it.
All right.
I had to talk about that game. It's just, everybody's been playing it, and everybody's been telling me. I'm like, it's not really that scary, but you know, it's a little creepy. It actually really is more creepy than any other horrors. And everyone's like, no, it's not. Like that game's not creepy. No game's creepy. And they literally, I've had two people so far come up and apologize to me for saying that it wasn't creepy, because they were like, actually, it's really scary. I was playing with this with XXX, and we were just screaming. And I just think it's very brilliant and original, because it's not scary in any kind of a gory, bloody, it's going to kill you scary way. It's just scary in its own unique, I don't want to be here way. Which is really nice, because anybody can play it, any age group, and it's equally scary to everyone, without being menacing. And it's free. It's just a great game. I just really love it. I've been playing a lot of Slender recently, and even I don't get the whole I can't wait to be scared thing, but, you know, it's a great game. I've been playing it. Everybody should play it. Go out there.
Okay, well, thank you, Thai. We better wrap up the show there for today, because we've been, I think we're coming up to our hour of stuff. So thank you, Thai, for joining the show today, and thank you very much for writing the show notes for today's show. And how can people find you and keep up to date in what you're doing?
My email is tig@picturenword.com. Oh, Yana's on, by the way. Hi, Yana. There were a lot more people on a while ago, and you know, a few of them left the live stream. Anyway, people can find me tig@picturenword.com, or my Facebook, Tig Skooma Science, all one word. Skooma is in the drug in Skyrim. Wagstaff. Or you can get me on my email, as I've just said before. You can contact me any number of ways. Not much more to say than that, really. I don't imagine anybody really will be contacting me, but if you do, get me on my email is probably the best method. I'll be sure to respond to you in about half a day then, if you do get me on my email. Facebook, I'm on once a day.
Great. Well, thank you, Thaig, for joining me on this episode of Midweek Tech. You can follow me on Twitter @TalksAboutTech, and be sure to watch us live, 8:30 every Wednesday, 8:30 GMT. And we have a great chat room. You know, you can interact with us and talk with us while we're doing the show. There's a great
and the other people
pre-show.
Watching the show, who are personalities, all of them.
Yep. So, you know, you should check it out live as well. And also check out our other show, Talks About Tech Weekly on the network. We record that live every Sunday at 8:30 GMT. So check out that show as well. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for watching or listening to this episode of Midweek Tech. And until next time, goodbye.